Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Kansas City spent last year bone dry, and this year rainfall is about normal. So it may be a task for us to recall when our part of the world was awash. But that's the way things were 20 years ago this month. In July 1993, after months of rain, the Missouri River rose and kept rising, sloshing into towns upstream and down. The Kansas River rose too, and the big reservoirs upstream from Kansas City swelled to unprecedented heights. The levees and flood walls around Kansas City's bottoms held back the rivers, but only by a matter of inches. Parkville and Riverside weren't so lucky. Neither were businesses along Southwest Boulevard, which turned into a river of its own when Turkey Creek simply refused to mind humankind's effort to reroute it. Today, we'll look back 20 years at those floods of 1993. With us to talk about it is Kenneth Keyser. He's an outdoor writer, photographer, novelist, and the author of Missouri's Great Flood of 93, Revisiting an Epic Natural Disaster. It was just published by Northeast News. Kenny helped sandbag the riverfront at Parkville in 1993 and then made scores of photographs, more than 80 of which appear in his book. Also with us is John Grothaus, Chief of Planning and Formulation for the Army Corps of Engineers Kansas City District. Among other duties, he supervises the Corps' flood protection efforts here. And we're joined by Laura Ziegler, a special correspondent for KCUR, a reporter and producer. In 1993, as Midwest correspondent for National Public Radio, she covered the floods. Welcome, all of you, to Central Standard Friday.
Glad to be here.
Kenny, let's talk to you. Now, you and countless other people spent hours and hours sandbagging Parkville in 1993, and it still didn't stop the water. Tell us what that was like.
Amazing. We did the sandbagging, and to us it seemed like, you know, it was ridiculous sandbagging as high as we did just across the railroad tracks. We thought there's no way on earth the water will go this high, but we did go 7 or 8 high, I believe. And a gentleman, I believe from the Army Corps of Engineers, came in and marked up the street and said, here's where the water's going to stop. And it was way past our mark, and we were just, you know, no way, impossible. Sure enough, when I started photographing with the police departments and the fire departments, we stopped and measured, and the water was almost 6 foot right at that point above the top sandbag.
Mm-hmm. So you were out there putting sands into the bags, making up the bags, lifting them, putting them down, sweating, no doubt?
Yes, yes, and it was hot. And when you throw sandbags, sometimes the sand, as tight as those bags are, you still get a little sand on your forearms, and it does tend to bite into the skin a little bit, especially when you're sweating.
I bet. Even down the Mississippi to places like St. Genevieve, a town from the 1700s in Missouri, people were getting experience doing sandbags that year, an experience they may not have duplicated much since then. What an amazing volunteer effort that must have taken. Laura Ziegler, the people came out of the woodwork to help out in that flood, didn't they?
They did, Monroe. All over across the Missouri Basin, across the entire state. And of course, the flood was a 9-state event, but the part that I covered, around here, I thought several places in particular where I was. Bean Lake is one, just north of Weston. And I was sort of looking back to refresh my memory, and I saw a YouTube video online, and it reminded me so much of being in a boat and going out with some homeowners whose homes were flooded, and riding in this boat and seeing the roofs of houses and the very tops of cars and post boxes and street signs, where people were trying to ascertain where their houses were by the street signs. There were, of course, no streets. People came from all over the country to help one another. It was a real outpouring of community effort.
And it was, even Quincy, Illinois had a problem with the levee breaking. I remember I-635 was simply severed by floodwaters.
Yeah. Well, major highways across the Midwest were closed, decimated, destroyed. It was, I think they call it, they call it the worst flood. Of course, they called it a 500-year flood, and I think there's some controversy about what that really means, but the worst flood event in American history, because not only of the duration, but the fact that it kept raining. I mean, there was no relief from it day after day. The town of Pattonsburg, for example, which they entirely moved, sort of dried up in a way that they could begin to repair, and then they had another flood because the water upstream flooded again, because it just kept raining and raining and raining.
Well, that's what I recall about July 1993. There were the flood came in phases. Early in the month, I think it was that I looked it up. It was the 10th. I was driving along I-35, and Southwest Boulevard is flooded. But it was not until later in the month that the rivers rose and nearly topped the flood walls here. And I suppose, John Grothaus, that was part of the work of the Corps of Engineers in 19. If the same amount of water in 51 might have had a different consequence.
Well, the Corps of Engineers is heavily involved in flood response and emergency assistance during flood fight, working with state community partners and other federal agencies. And so we play a big role, and we get to see it up close and personal, and we get to see the effects of that. And, you know, we do our best to support the folks in trying to lower the damages and protect areas wherever we can. Interesting, you've got in 1993, you not only had the big river, main river flooding, you also had the tributaries like Turkey Creek, mm-hmm. many of the tributaries going at the same time, which made it especially challenging for the community. We had a huge snowfall, that record snowfall that winter, mm-hmm. coming into 30 inches of rain from April through July, Kansas and Missouri, and then another 12 to 18 inches of rain on top of that in our area from June to July.
I think by way of comparison, I every now and then I check the newspaper after last year's drought to see what the average for this date is. And for this date, it's around 18 or 19 inches. And you said 30 inches from April to July. Right. And that'll cause a flood.
That's record setting.
A flood doesn't come, well, at least the ones in this area don't seem to come the way thunderstorms do, by announcing itself with lightning and thunder and crashing. It just might even be a sunny day, and all of a sudden this muddy water comes seeping up. Is that y'all's experience too?
It's not unusual to have flooding during a drought.
Yeah.
In other words, you like in the 2011 flood, it was an upper basin flood of record, but yet we saw the effects of it downstream in the midst of a dry time because the releases came out of the reservoirs on the main stem.
So. And that got as close as to us as on the Missouri as Atchison just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, there was some records set up in the northern part of the Missouri River up around the Nebraska border in St. Joseph. And then down here, it was almost a non-event, even though it was a prolonged high flow. It was almost a non-event down
the
lower
river. I remember it flowed. It flooded the riverside in Parkville.
Mm-hmm.
They were sandbagging there, and there was water. There was, you know, there were probably 6 inches or a foot of water over the levee. I mean, over the river top in Parkville.
Right. The English Landing Park gets flooded fairly frequently.
So. Yeah. I remember in Riverside, too, they were sandbagging there, and they didn't have any indication that it was going to come as quickly as it did. And then I believe the levee there was breached, where now is the Argosy and the Horizon development there. But there was a private levee there? I can't remember.
In 93, there was a private levee in Riverside.
Yeah, there was a levee district
there. And the
whole
city, basically the big part of the city flooded.
Yep. It came slowly at first, and then all of a sudden it just rushed in. Zeke Young, who I was visiting again recently, but I remember talking to his dad, Ed Young, and they have renamed that park E.H. Young after him along the river there, told me that they didn't expect it to come so quickly, and then all of a sudden it rose feet. I mean, there's a sign of you can see how high the water is. And again, there are, I recall going around in boats there, the Red X Pharmacy, which is that iconic old pharmacy in Riverside, was flooded up to the roof. You can see the water mark there, eight inches from the ceiling. And that was a tragedy because that thing had been there since the 40s, and he had collectibles from all over the world, and it came so rapidly. They had started to sandbag, but they had no indication because you can probably explain the engineering of that, but I know that levee doesn't have – now it has all kinds of technology and devices built in to mitigate some of that pressure, but – it was pressure from upstream.
Yeah, there's a federal levee there now. The 1944 Flood Control Act authorized a series of federal levees on the river. Missouri River Levee System is the acronym for that authorization. And Missouri River Levee System 385 is now constructed at Riverside, which will greatly improve their flood protection now as opposed to then.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and we're talking about the floods of 1993, 20 years ago this month. Where were you during the flood? How did it affect you? Tell us your story by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us. Our handle is KCURCST. The river is protected. We just talked about a private levee and their core levees. And I know after the flood of 1903 in Kansas City, a drainage district or a levee district was set up by local governments. How is it decided what part of the river, John, is protected by what agency?
Well, there are certain federal levees were authorized by the 1944 Flood Control Act, and essentially the 1936 Flood Control Act authorized the Kansas City metropolitan system, which protects, you know, well over $20 billion in fixed investment just in the Kansas City metro area at the Kansas and Missouri confluence. And those are authorized by Congress based upon requests from local partners like cities, counties, and levee districts. And most of the large levees, all the large levees are now constructed and in place. And we and the local owners and federal levees, even though they are federally constructed levees, they generally protect areas of heavy investment. Even though they're federal levees, they're owned and operated by a local sponsor once we construct them. And so Kansas City metropolitan area has multiple levee owners, including the city and several levee districts.
Mm. So in the flood of 1951, when the Kaw River splashed into the West Bottoms and got the stockyards and all those businesses that were operating down there then, the improvement after that would have been your improvement, which kept the water out this in 1993, but it still has to be maintained by local agencies.
Right, owned and operated by the drainage districts. The 1951 flood was a Kansas River flood primarily, and you had rainfall forming over essentially a two-day period in July over a 9,000-square-mile basin that just shows you how severe the flood risk and how sudden the flood risk can be for Kansas City.
Hmm. Kenny Kieser, you have produced a book here with photographs you took back in 93 of the flood. Were you riding around in a boat to take some of those?
Yes, with police department and fire department personnel.
Uh-huh. And do you recall being hard? Was it difficult to find your way with the street signs and everything nearly underwater?
Not too bad. You know, we certainly know the areas well enough. And, of course, this was their area, so they were driving the boat. But to me, it was just a shock to see places I'd known all my life flooded. Like Red X, for example, the water up to the eaves.
It's so shocking to see, it, just visually, to watch a flood take over stuff you knew. We're so dependent on roads and our cars, and then there's no place to drive anymore. It's just amazing. Well, if you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 816-235-2888. And we have a call from Jeff in Richmond, Missouri. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. How are you?
We are all fine.
Well, in 1993, I was a regular member of Walt Bodine's community of people who called him frequently and talked about whatever was going on. And that was before cell phones. I was called in from payphones. So I was standing out in a howling gully washer about 10 years or 20 years ago today at a payphone and talking to him. And he said, "What's the weather like today?" And I said, "Well, Walt, I'll tell you, this is one of those days that Turkey Creek jumps out of that fake bed they built for it and goes back to its old natural bed and roars right down Southwest Boulevard." And it did.
Oh, my gosh. In fact, Turkey Creek, Jeff, is the fake bed. The old bed would have gone down in sort of the cleft in the hills, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the old bed. Southwest Boulevard is the natural old bed.
Uh-huh.
You've got West 39th Street on the top of one ridge, and you've got that ridge over there where there's a bunch of industry that's up behind Ponax, behind I-35, is the other ridge. And it naturally went right down Southwest Boulevard and cut around that ridge where 670 and stuff cuts off, and it ran. They rerouted it to build the switching yards at Union Station.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Well, Jeff, so it ran through there. That was it. Naturally, dumped into the Missouri, not the Kaw.
It wants to defy our best efforts to alter its course.
Yeah,
it?
It's not at all convinced that we know what we're doing. Of course, the Missouri River is not at all convinced that we know what we're doing either.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thanks very much for calling. John Grothaus of the Corps, talk to us a little bit about that. The Kirky Creek was rerouted way back in 1919. And you guys, in improving it and trying to get, well, at least trying to keep it from flooding businesses, have found some pretty interesting things along the way.
Yes, Turkey Creek, Jeff's right. Turkey Creek was rerouted, and they built a 1,300-foot tunnel, horseshoe-shaped tunnel, at the turn of the last century. During World War I, when tunneling technology was really coming into its own, they built a pretty amazing structure. It's a 28-foot horseshoe diameter concrete lined tunnel, and they designed that tunnel big enough to take the highest flows Turkey Creek could be estimated to deliver, and it's still very robust, but they didn't make the channel big enough. And so in the tunnel, when we found it, partnering with Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, KDOT, the Corps of Engineers has built a wider channel there to be able to accept more flows and lower the flood damages. And also we found a 60 by 40 foot cavern underneath that tunnel, inside the tunnel, where the water had eaten into weak layers of rock, potentially undermining I-35. So not only were we able to shore up the flood protection, but pouring high-strength concrete into those voids, we were able to also protect I-35 from potential problems later at the same time.
So, if you're traveling along I-35 at 55, 60, 65, or however fast you dare to go down I-35 into town or out of downtown, you hardly know that you're traveling over that tunnel, but you are. And, of course, it was built many years after the tunnel was built. And so there was actually a threat to driver safety there.
There was a threat, I wouldn't say to driver safety, but a long-term, intermediate to long-term threat to the highway having to be shored up, and it eventually let go, it could be. But fortunately, working with KDOT and the cities, we proactively addressed the problem, and now the tunnel seems to be working real well. They designed it real well. We just had to widen the channel to help out with more flood protection. We used to call it flood control, but we know enough, like Jeff says, that we can't control Mother Nature. Now we call it flood damage reduction or flood risk management, because we know we don't try and control Mother Nature's river systems.
That's interesting. We have a caller now. Let's go to Al in Kansas City. Good morning, Al.
Good morning. I just remember during that time I was coming in from Parkville every day into the city, and I was coming down across the Broadway Bridge so you could go past the downtown airport, and the water was rising daily to the point where at one point it was to the top of the levee. So you were basically at the same level as the water. And I remember thinking, if this levee wasn't here, North Kansas City would be underwater. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, the levee, the Kansas City Metropolitan Levee System performed largely very well, performed as designed during a 93 flood. However, the 93 flood gave us a chance to observe our, kind of like almost like in a laboratory, we got a chance to observe the flood protection system under a major load or a major test. We learned some things about it.
That was my observation, you know, that any more water could have breached the levee. Could it have breached the levee?
Yeah, it was within 2 to 3 feet of the top of the levee.
I know, it was amazing. Okay, I just wanted to throw that in. Bye.
All right, thanks, Al. Now let's go to Alfonso in Kansas City. Good morning, Alfonso.
Good morning.
What's your memory of the flood?
Well, I had a restaurant in Parkville, Missouri, and we started getting water racing on the 10th of July. We had all kinds of experts, which none of them really had any experience in flood. Most of them were very proud. That was their first one. Some from the Army Corps of Engineers were marking with paint where the water was going to crest. And I wasn't even close. It was way past that. And also, this flood was man-made. It was not a natural thing. They start releasing the reservoirs up the stream in order to save them, prompting the levees from the farmers to break down, and that's what we got flooded. We saw coffins floating. We saw what I thought was things, but actually were gas or propane tanks going by, trash, all kinds of things, dead deer, trees, farming. So they were used driving by, and the water being dragged on.
Wow, that's
I don't think the Army Corps of Engineers really understand the river. It has been straightened out to the point that it has no to take care of the excess water. And you like FEMA with no idea what they were doing. We had city inspectors coming over from border towns nearby, including Kansas City. No idea what was going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Alfonso,
we had all kinds of incredible volunteers from Florida, from Illinois, from Nebraska that came over to clean up.
Alfonso, thanks so very much for giving us a call this morning. But let's give the Army Corps of Engineers a chance to respond. John?
Well, the Corps of Engineers, the Missouri River flood of 1993 was a lower basin flood. So we had approximately 540,000 cubic feet per second flowing at the peak in July below the Kansas City gauge at Hannibal, below the confluence of the Missouri and the Kansas rivers. But the upstream lakes had very little, the main Sim lakes had very little to do with the 93 flood. They were releasing on order of 6,000 to 8,000 cubic feet per second during the flood as compared to that, and holding back a lot of water that would have just made things worse. If it weren't for those upstream lakes, things would have been only worse down here, and some levees might have overtopped in the urban areas.
Let me ask you, John, what is the lower basin definition of the Missouri?
I call it, from Gavin's Point, from the Sioux City or Gavin's Point south, and most of the rainfall and the precipitation that caused the 93 flood was the lower basin. It was a nominal, and I say nominal because estimates of flooding at a 500-year frequency are only estimates until we have 1,000 or 500 or 1,000 years of gauge records like they do in Europe. It's very tough to say what really is a 500-year flood, so we can only estimate that. And there was a flood of record of 93 in the lower basin. 2011 was a flood of record in the upper basin on a large Missouri River system of thousands of miles. Records occur at different times in different places. There's not just one 500-year flood on the whole system. You're going to have multiple records set at different places.
And those main stem lakes you were talking about are those big reservoirs up in the Dakotas.
And they held back a lot of water during 93 that would have made things worse. And had they not been there in 2011, there would have been several feet more of flooding.
Okay. So we have a little bit of the, there's always a controversy, I imagine, on who's responsible. I think I read a quote in looking back through some old stories in the Star that some people in Parkville thought the levees in Kansas City had pushed the water back to Parkville or were keeping it from, or helping it flood in Parkville. Kenny, do you remember that complaint?
Yeah, I heard it. The combination of a perfect storm. You know, of course, when the water from the Missouri River hit the Mississippi River, water does not condense, so it just hit it and went backwards, of course. But I was, you know, and you can blame the Corps of Engineers all you want for 93, but I'm not sure that they were totally responsible. 93 was the result of a perfect storm, really. You know, Mike Thompson, the chief meteorologist for Channel 4 News, gave me a wonderful, wonderful interview for this book. And it started with the year before when Mount Pinatubo, an equatorial volcano in the Philippines, blew up, and it threw lots of ash up into the stratosphere. And then, of course, you had the jet stream. It was cool. It cooled the Earth down for four years, more so than it had been in some time. And the jet stream carried a lot of this back into here. And then El Nino, I never say that right, it was throwing tropical moisture up as well. A combination of all that cooled the globe down. The jet stream hung over the Midwest longer than it normally would have. Normally, by June and July, it's moved back north, but it didn't this time, and there was more rain in this area than ever before. A combination of that, a combination of the wet winter before, with the ground was saturated already, and that created lots of runoff. In the Kansas River basins alone, you had as much as 4 foot of water at times in a short period of time. That's not 4 inches of rain. That's 4 foot of rain coming down. That's a lot of water hitting all at once.
And I remember a lot of people telling me, too, at the time, you talk about the ground being saturated. A lot of people had seepage. They had water coming up from the ground because there was no place else for that water to go. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people had flooding in their basements and in their homes because water was actually coming up from the ground.
And that was another issue. A lot of the sewers backed up. A lot of your, of course, all your tributaries are throwing water in there, and the sewers are backing up. That's throwing a lot of water from all directions.
Okay, thanks, guys. Fascinating topic, and we'll be back after the break. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're talking about the floods of 1993, 2 decades ago this month. With us are Kenny Keezer, who's written a book about the flood. It's called Missouri's Great Flood of 93, Revisiting an Epic Natural Disaster. Also with us are KCUR reporter and producer Laura Ziegler, who covered the flooding for NPR, and the chief in planning and formulation for the Army Corps of Engineers, John Grothaus. What are your memories of the flood? Was your home or business affected? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And if you'd like to tweet us, our handle is KCURCST. Guys, one of the most poignant memories of that flood for me, and I think for anybody who read about it, it was in the stories in the New York Times, of course, the local media, and television and radio did it, was the cemetery at Hardin, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Laura Ziegler, you covered that. Tell us what happened there.
Well, as you say, it was they called it the worst graveyard disaster in the world. Of course, I guess we wouldn't know if that's happened around the world, but they did get coverage internationally. And what happened there was the Missouri River came up over this graveyard, which is actually relatively high ground. It's about 15 miles from Richmond, I think, and that's where the river runs along. And the whole valley there, the whole space between Richmond and the neighboring town, including Hardin, which is a little hamlet, were submerged, covered in probably 4 or 5 feet of water. And there's a 100-year-old cemetery there with about 1,500 graves, and they were just unearthed. And the water rushed in so quickly that it actually gouged a lake in the middle of the cemetery. And vaults, grave coffins and vaults rushed downriver. Many of them actually were sucked down into the silt of this lake that was created by the rushing water. And tombstones and bodies that had come out of the coffins. And so what they have now, I was just actually there to revisit. I remember at the time just going and talking to people, and they were just devastated. I mean, it was like losing loved ones. And there were generations of people from that community there. Everybody knew each other. It's a very, very small town. And it was as if people were grieving the loss of their grandparents, their sons, their daughters. One woman had a stillborn baby who she had buried the day after. So it was very emotional and heart-wrenching at the time. Now when you go there, it's more kind of a memory of combating, overcoming this devastation, because what they were able to do is recover most of these bodies and most of these coffins. And what you see when you go there is a lake in between two pieces of a cemetery. And that's the lake where they still, the director of the cemetery still told me there were probably some bodies and tombstones buried in the silt that they couldn't recover. But most of them they did get. And on one side of the lake is a very neat series of about 8 rows of tombstones lined up in a cement platform, row by row. And those were the tombstones that they recovered either from downriver or from this lake that were washed away. And most of those do not have bodies associated with them because they couldn't recover or they couldn't identify the bodies. Oh. So they are in a separate place in sort of a mass grave identified with just markers, headstones, just those little pieces of rock, little pieces of granite with a number, unknown number 154. And then on the other side of this lake are a scattering of tombstones, some of them large, some of them just small headstones, that were either just knocked over or moved slightly. So some of those may have bodies with them, and some of them may be just the headstones. And a woman that I talked to recently was the granddaughter of her grandmother and grandfather who were buried there. And she said she's so grateful just to have a stone there that has a marker, even if it's unknown, because the only thing her grandmother ever asked for was for her to put flowers on her grave every year.
Oh, my gosh.
So she can go back to this stone, even though it's unknown, or she can go back to the tombstone that has her name on it and put flowers on the grave, even if she doesn't know her grandmother is there.
Wow, that's amazing that what the people had to put up to you.
But it took them 5 years, and the director of the cemetery told me that they got donations from as far away as Germany to help them with this effort.
The news traveled worldwide. What poignant things occurred during the flood of 1993, 20 years ago this month. You can call us to tell us your experiences at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, as has Steve from Lenexa. Steve, good morning.
Oh, hi. I remember I did some work for the Corps of Engineers and other emergency management agencies back in 93, providing some equipment. And I remember getting the impression distinctly that there was a lot of concern about the dams and the reservoirs up the Kansas River
Perry and Milford and Tuttle Creek. And particularly Milford, I remember being asked to rush in the middle of the night some emergency floodlighting equipment up there because they had let so much water out, they were afraid it was going to undermine the dam. And I wonder what the impact would have been if any of those dams had been breached.
Well, we have very, very strict response measures in place to make sure that those dams don't breach, and that we up to a point, those dams hold back water to protect from flooding. But when they get up to a point where they're full, like the main stems did in 2011, then we have to prioritize releasing water to make sure there's not a catastrophic failure. And at some point, we can't hold back water anymore. We just have to pass what Mother Nature sends us that overcomes the capacity of the lakes or the volume in the bathtub. In 93, we had 15 of our 18 lakes in our district were increased critical surveillance. And we had emergency spillway operating at Tuttle Creek Lake, and the emergency spillways operating at Milford and Rathbun Lakes. And, you know, we had 570,000 cubic feet per second in the Missouri, 170,000 cubic feet per second in the Kansas River. 180,000 cubic feet per second is enough water to dump out a Milford Lake every day. So that just gives [S2] Wow. [S1] You a feel for the magnitude of what we're dealing with. And the caller makes a very good point about the lakes. We're a critical point of emphasis, and we make sure that they're safe above all things.
Yeah. One quick remark. At my church in 1993, a woman's mother had been lost at the Hardin Cemetery, and she came to church one day and told us that Mom got to go on that cruise she never got to go on.
Oh, gosh. Well, a bit of grim humor. Steve, thank you so much for your call. Speaking of those upstream lakes like Milford and Perry, that's exactly why they were built, John Grothaus, right after the plan started after World War II, to impound water and keep floods from happening. And they sort of kind of did their job in 93, didn't they?
Yes, sir. The lakes did their job quite well in terms of flood protection. They were designed in the Pick-Sloan Act and subsequent laws for flood protection. They also provide multiple other benefits, including 60% of the water supply for the state of Kansas comes from Corps of Engineers lakes, also a big recreation area for the state of Kansas and Missouri come from those lakes. But we prevented 13 – in the 93 flood alone, we estimate our flood protection structures prevented about $14 billion in damages. The Kansas City District lakes prevented $4 billion of those damages by virtue of the huge amount of flood storage they provide. So –
the flood storage that occurs in those lakes, I had a personal experience with a year later in 1994 in summer. I was on the in the boat launching ramp area at Milford Lake and looked up, and way high up in the trees, seemingly 20, 30 feet, was debris that had floated up there. That's how high the lake had gotten. It's just astoundingly high what happened to those lakes.
The power of Mother Nature is very impressive, and no one should ever underestimate that. We try not to.
You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. 20 years later, do you see any lasting effects from the flood? Is there anywhere where you still see the remnants of devastation? You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or send us a tweet at KCURCST. Now we have Carrie from Kansas City. And good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
What's your best memory of the flood?
Actually, my husband and I got married in July of 93, and he was living in Kansas City, and I was from St. Joe, and all of our, like, family had to, like, sometimes 2 hours to get around flooded areas to get to St. Joe to be able to attend the wedding, and a few people ended up late and things like that. And then it's interesting because we are on a family vacation this week with our kids traveling across Missouri, and just about the same time we were getting married 20 years ago, and we were traveling I-70, and we were trying to get a hotel room the day after we got married, and we couldn't find one because it was full of all the people that, you know, were out of their homes and kept sleeping in our car overnight in a U-Haul, so...
On your honeymoon.
What a honeymoon that was.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. We ended up pulling U-Haul into a lot of school buses, and we just went in a cab overnight, and when we woke up in the morning, all the buses were gone, so it was pretty funny. But
All right, Carrie, thanks so much for calling. Speaking of highways and roads, lots of highways were closed, and others were severely damaged and had to be replaced after the flood. So the network of transportation was affected for many years by that. As I understand it, a lot of railroad lines had to reroute themselves through town. Kenny Kieser, what other kind of transportation things have you do you recall?
Well, on the railroad side, it was $30 million damage or loss, and gosh, hundreds of secondary roads, a few major highways, and airports were closed. 17,000 square miles flooded in the Midwest alone.
Uh-huh.
So that's covering a lot of different places.
And here in Kansas City, we've long been the second biggest rail hub in America. So mm-hmm. to think about rerouting yourself around that would take a lot of traffic.
I think for the most part in the Midwest, you just shut them down for at least 30 days, and who knows how much longer, because they had to survey each piece of track to make sure that the flood hadn't damaged it. And it did, of course, damage some tracks.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about St. Joe. St. Joe was pretty hard hit as well. All the way down from St. Joe down to Kansas City. They had a big struggle up there. Do you remember, John, what the...
The right bank levee at St. Joe, Elwood, Wathena, Kansas, mm-hmm. and the Rosecrans Airport and Air National Guard Bay, that levee overtopped because the water got too high in that area, flooded maybe as upwards $60 to $80 million of damages and a lot of disrupted lives and things like that. And you all bring out, you all bring out the other thing that people don't think of necessarily all the time is secondary effects is infrastructure, roads, cemeteries, and things like that, in addition to businesses and homes.
And that when they go underwater, they don't just dry out and everything's back to normal.
That's correct. It takes a lot of money to get things back and running, and the railroad lines go down, then there's diversion cost, detour costs, and those costs are huge.
The previous big flood in Kansas City, and perhaps the one that's best remembered by a lot of people, was 1951, that did take a lot of the businesses in the West Bottoms, but also flooded a lot of homes in Armourdale and Argentine. And I can remember in 1993 hearing word that the people in Armourdale, right down there in the bottoms of Kansas City, Kansas, were being evacuated, and apparently about 3,500 people were, but this time Armourdale was lucky. Why this time?
Well, there was some in 51, there was some loss of life, too.
Yes.
And, you know, this time, since 1951, we were authorized and constructed improved levees in the 60s and 70s in the Kansas River system, and those have provided more protection now to help against major floods since 51.
Laura Ziegler, were you around when those evacuations were occurring?
In 51?
No.
93. Sorry. Not quite that old. I was, yeah. And I want to mention, too, that some 50 people died in 1993 in the course of
that flood.
Across
Missouri, I believe.
Across the region, I think, across the nine-state region. I'm not sure exactly where they all were. Some did die. Some did pass away. And I wasn't in any communities where people actually died, but... That's important to note.
I think if you check the record, flooding is still the most severe, the most prominent cause of damage and loss of life in disasters worldwide. I think that's still the truth.
Wow. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today we're talking about the floods of 1993, 20 years ago this month, July 1993. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us what you remember about the flood of 1993. What did it do to your life, your business, your home? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can email us also at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Mark from Kansas City has done just that. He asks, why do people allow continued development of floodplains? Why does that happen?
Well, that's a subject of great controversy. I think now John made reference to the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers has redefined its definition of what they do, basically. And instead of trying to control what happens to the flood, it's what do you call it? Flood management.
It was flood control, then it was flood damage reduction. Now the term is flood risk management.
Flood risk management. And, you know, I remember asking that question of people in 1993, and I've gone back and asked a number of people that question now. And I think there's this kind of rugged individualism attitude about it. People that have lived there all their lives, have lived there for generations, are just willing to take the risk. You know, they like where they live. They like their communities. They like living by the river.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have actually changed their mind and moved out of the floodplain. I don't know if they were flooded in 51 and again in 93 and just thought that's enough, or if they were flooded in 93. And again, earlier in the show, we made reference to Pattonsburg, where a number of people just took federal buyouts and they moved the entire community. That was controversial at the time, too. There were a lot of people that didn't feel like they were getting a fair offer for their property and that they didn't want the government telling them what to do. So they didn't do it. But, you know, Riverside is a good example. Zeke Young will say now, you know, his dad at the time said, you know, we're just going to roll up our sleeves and rebuild. These people need the jobs that they have here. People depend on this institution. The Red X Pharmacy was an iconic institution.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they just they accept the risk and they are, you know, maybe skeptical about what the Army Corps of Engineers, they thank what, you know, they appreciate what they're doing. They know that, you know, you can't control Mother Nature, but they want to be there.
Kenny.
Well, the places like the north side of Sugar Lake up towards up south of St. Joe, or and there was a town called Cedar City,
mm-hmm.
down towards St. Louis. It 93 wiped it out, and I believe FEMA stepped in and bought all those properties so nothing more would be built there. I know they did on the north side of Sugar Lake as well, and they decided, you know, there's no point people trying to rebuild when, so they just bought them out and just. I'm not sure how much they got for the properties or if it's fair value. I assume it was. Who knows?
The supposedly fair market value, but it is, as Laura said, very controversial. And it's a tough situation because they're considering modifying flood insurance and flood response, and all those laws are being considered by Congress and federal agencies nationally. But it's a very tough situation, and Laura summed it up very eloquently what the challenge is.
There's not only some sentimental reasons for wanting to stay in your community or operate your business where you've been operating it. There's a couple of practical reasons, too. Often floodplain properties would be lower rents,
mm-hmm.
or lower costs for purchase.
Well, I know I've read and talked to a number of people recently who referred to the fact that for many years after 93, nobody did build or develop in the floodplain. And gradually, you know, that development and those industrial complexes creep in because it is a good value. Or in the case of Riverside, the casino built there. And, of course, they provide a great tax base to help subsidize flood management, risk management. So, you know, that's a good example where there has been development creeping in there. And I think the same for residential development in many floodplains. People have a short memory.
Yeah, we get lulled into complacency the longer it recedes, and this has receded 20 years ago. We do have a Twitter comment from a listener. It was my first ever experience at filling sandbags. I will never forget the feeling, though, of a team effort, even when things seemed hopeless. So it can build community as well as tear down some communities, too. That's great that way. St. Louis, you mentioned, Cedar Point near St. Louis, the aerial photographs where the Missouri met the Mississippi and basically became just an inland sea there. You couldn't see the rivers. Those, Kenny, those were amazing to me.
Yeah, all the way up to the steps of the arch, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Just an incredible amount of water. I mean, you've coming in from both directions, probably their saving grace was the Missouri hitting the Mississippi and backing up. Or imagine if all that had mixed together what it had been like.
Yeah, and so you could drive a long way, as Carrie mentioned, and not get out of the, leave the effects of the flooding. And so the Mississippi River, it wasn't, John, it wasn't the subject of rain. That was just Missouri pouring into it that caused it that way, or did rain do that?
Yeah, you know, the Mississippi River, the Mississippi Basin had some rainfall. I'm not terribly familiar, but they did have flooding in 93. And then the officials like the general in charge of the Mississippi Valley Division Corps of Engineers took some heat in 2008 when people said, hey, you told us 93 in some areas was a 500-year flood. Now we're having another one. But again, I say it all depends on where you are in the river, where the record is set. And you can have two 500-year floods in the same river system 2 years apart. It just depends on where you are, where the water falls. No flood is the same. All floods are different. They have different origins. They peak at different places and different times, and they all have very different characteristics. Even the time of year affects the water temperature. Things like that have all kinds of different effects. Very complicated.
Kenny.
Well, this was a unique flood. I mean, and they call it the 500-year flood because of the perfect storm creating it. And Flood records are broken at 49 individual points on the Missouri River and 44 on the Mississippi. Many stretches of the river broke flood records by over 4 feet. And this is probably, I imagine these records all the way back to the paddle wheel days, probably. And yes. When they had to keep records, you know.
On most of the Missouri River, in Missouri River, the 93 flood did set, is the record flood for the lower Missouri River in Missouri in terms of stage, absolutely, in terms of elevation.
Now, in terms of protecting people from this, we briefly mentioned insurance. Somebody tell us what's happened to flood insurance requirements and so forth in the 20 years since.
I know that there's a national study, you know, it's a process nationally to look at how flood insurance is done because there is certainly some questions being asked about continually funding people in the floodplain, and that's those questions need to be asked and need to be looked at. The answers are not simple. In some places, there's intensive in-depth in development or urbanization that had we able to turn the clock back, we wouldn't do it. But since it's there, in some areas, it makes sense to protect it. In some areas, it makes sense to relocate or move out or handle it through risk management and flood preparedness, response, and flood awareness and forecasting rather than a structural project. The Corps gets involved in all those areas now. We spend a lot of money on preparation, response, and better forecasting and data sharing with other federal agencies and working with state and local communities. And looking at areas that aren't protected, how can we better manage the risk and better prepare people to respond and avoid damages wherever possible? So we spend a lot of our efforts working collaboratively with agencies, communities on the non-structural aspects, we call it.
Flood insurance is not even possible to get for a lot of people.
Yeah, and aren't the Army Corps, the Corps standards are a lot more stringent now. And I imagine that plays into what flood insurance you're eligible for. In other words, if you don't meet certain core standards set by the federal government, then the eligibility standards have changed or much stricter than they used to be.
Yes, yeah, since Katrina and even before Katrina, FEMA and Corps of Engineers have been looking at making levees safer and more reliable and better understanding risk and how to address risk in a more informed manner. And so we're looking at levee standards increasing, we're heightening our levee inspection standards, and not only the Corps of Engineers and FEMA, but insurance underwriters, major insurance underwriters that underwrite businesses behind levees also have engineering organizations equivalent to ours that are looking at the same thing. So there's been a lot of emphasis on improving reliability and improving knowledge and awareness of flood risk, and that's a good thing.
Let's go now to a caller, Bob from Kansas City, Kansas. Bob, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. I just wanted to add that I worked for a utility company in 93, and we got called in the night of the flood. And we worked around the clock, some of us 3-4 days, until the superintendents came out and just made us get in the trucks, take a nap for a couple hours, and then get back at it.
Wow. Grueling work, no sleep. But I guess you were driven by the impending disaster, huh?
Yeah, we started out having to bag up various substations, the control, small control buildings and that. And then we went down behind Indian Springs, and it was just, like the one caller said, the team effort was massive. And I think everybody got in the spirit of that.
Huh. How many people were without power and for how long? Do you remember?
Well, you know, I don't remember the exact number, but I know that to get people back on, we worked for probably close to another week even after that.
Because mm-hmm. I remember going around to houses that where people had water receding and they were trying to be in cleanup, but it was dark. So,
yeah,
and they were. I remember one house there was a snake, and this everybody got really freaked out because they couldn't see the snake.
Oh, sure.
And that means people didn't have air conditioning or even fans, and certainly not lights. Amazing.
They were losing their food. There were even, unfortunately, a few guys in trucks went through and seeing what they could do from houses and. Between the police, all the different crews and everything, we kept an eye on them, and they were down a couple. So,
well, Bob, thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Eric in Kansas City, Missouri. Eric, good morning.
Well, my best friend and I are professional pilots, and he was living in Parkville at the time, and his house was not affected, but his pilot logbooks were in a deposit bank downtown that was completely buried in the water. And I remember visiting him at flood, and he had his logbooks completely taken apart at the bank, and he had each page laid out all over his entire house, trying to dry them out so he could get his records. These records, the only records you ever experience, they're used for FAA documentation, insurance documentation, or job interviews, your experience.
Wow.
As a result of this really tedious disaster for him, I changed the way I keep my records. I never make an entry in the logbook that isn't waterproof ink. I developed a page numbering system for my logbook so that I could put them together again if I ever had to.
Well, that certainly makes sense, Eric. Thanks very much. Sorry we have to interrupt, but we've got to be going here. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guests have been Kenny Keyser, whose book is Missouri's Great Flood of 93, Revisiting an Epic Natural Disaster. With us also have been John Grothaus of the Corps of Engineers and KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Thanks to each of you for coming this morning. You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Up to Date is next with a look at art and indie films. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz. Our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is KCUR. Thanks and enjoy your weekend.